There is to keep the children or the child, the youth, from committing additional criminal activity while they're on release. So there's certain things that you impose, like curfews and things like that. The person you're releasing them to is the parent. And the parent's the one that enforces those rules, unlike in the adult situation. The parent, first of all, the judge, I need to know that the parent's willing and understands what those conditions are. And the second thing is, I want to have a dialogue with the parent because there might be some conditions the parent wants to control their child that I would also impose as a release condition, but I need to know what they are. If the parent can't speak English and I can't speak to that person first, I can't be assured that they will be able to take the child, which might mean the child is held longer in detention, which is another one of those over-representation issues of youth in detention and secure facilities, and maybe that doesn't need to happen. And the second thing is I need to make sure that parent understands they are in a position of power to call the court when there's problems with their children. One of the things that we've learned in terms of where children speak English and their parents don't is there's a power shift in those families, which is not appropriate, and the parents don't like it, and that kid ends up with a lot of power, and we don't want that to happen. And that I certainly don't want in my juvenile court proceeding to be relying on the delinquent, or the youth that's charged with the delinquent act, to explain to the parent what the conditions of probation or release are, rather, because you can imagine there's a little bit of problem with that translation. So that's why we think it's important. You might wonder why there's not a big fiscal impact, and I think the first time last time we came through, we thought there was a, you know, X as a fiscal impact. We went back and reevaluated, and the reason it's not real high is a lot of courts have other, you know, interpreters there for other cases. When the interpreters at the court to handle some cases, obviously they handle every case that's there. And so sometimes what we have been doing or can do now, or maybe have been doing, it shouldn't be, is using the people that are there to just go ahead and do it, even though we're not, you know, required to have an interpreter there, and we just use who's there. The other thing we've been doing a lot of, which I think which is unfair and it kind of changes county to county, have a lot of bilingual staff and pull them from whatever else they're doing and ask them to help us so that we don't, you know, create an injustice. But the smaller counties aren't in those positions, but the bigger counties have often interpreters that are there. And we also have a growing, Spanish is primarily the ones that you use, but we have Russian and Laotian and Cambodian. There's lots of other odd languages that you'd like to be able to appoint an interpreter for those parents. So that's all I wanted to say, unless anybody has any questions of me. Okay?
Nancy?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Nancy Miller. I'm the director of the Juvenile Court Programs Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. My division includes the Citizen Review Board and the Juvenile Court Improvement Project. Judge Legert covered most of the points that are in the written testimony. There's one section of the bill on the second page that talks about lines 11 and 12, talks about procedures for providing interpreters to people who have rights of limited participation. This provision actually applies to dependency cases, and we are seeing more and more relatives involved in dependency cases. Oftentimes, these folks may not speak English and may be a placement resource for the child, so we thought it was important to clarify that. Again, the fiscal impact isn't very large. It comes in under $50,000, and I believe even in those dependency cases, that is because often, if the relatives don't speak English, the parents don't speak English either, and we already have an interpreter there for parents in dependency cases. One thing that we have learned from the CRB perspective in reviewing thousands and thousands of cases is that if the parents are actively engaged and involved, the outcomes for the cases are much more positive. So we strongly support the bill and urge your support as well. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? I do have one question. You mentioned that the fiscal impact in this bill was under $50,000.
That's correct.
Is that only for the provision on line 11 and 12?
Mr. Chair, members, both. Whole thing.
For the whole thing?
Yes.
So $50,000 for Senate Bill 69.
$44,000-something.
Okay. We don't have a fiscal impact statement in front of us yet. So.
What we have is that it's less than the required amount to state, so it's less than the $50,000. That's a statement that we've received, but we haven't received a dollar amount.
Okay. Do we have a copy of that
document?
We do.
You should.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we should have it here. Senator Metzger, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. Judge, you were saying that in most cases, you basically have kind of had a makeshift plan because of people who may be available in the courthouse to interpret, to make this work. I was wondering, since you say this is important because of the fact that the parents may be the ones that are important to enforce the intermediary time by the time you're going through the hearing process with the juvenile until you finally adjudicate this. Has the fact that, has this created any legal problems? I mean, since you have the adults are the legal guardians, say, of a minor child, and you don't provide, because they were not available, did not provide any interpretation services for those adults, and yet had certain legal responsibilities for that child based on the instructions that only the child may have understood. I was just wondering if there's that create some problems there because they did not understand what their role was there?
Well, I haven't, thank you, Chair, Senator Metzger. I haven't had that come up in a particular case, but we're concerned whether there's a due process problem there. Yeah, I think you've hit the ball, you know, hit it on the nail on the head, whatever. That, and we've discussed whether that might become an issue that's raised in a different context. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, and so that is a concern we have, that maybe this is required under a due process analysis, but nobody's pushed us to that point yet. But I think there's definitely a concern.
Thank you.
Further questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This committee, I'm going to shock the members who are not used to me and my voice in this role, so I apologize to any members who have just been traumatized by that because I noticed everybody jumped. Wait a minute, I guess things are still going on here, right? Okay. I thought I'd look up and it'd be a new person, but no.
I want
to hang around. I don't know. Like, I'm sorry.
That's what they were hoping.
Okay.
Mr. Vice Chair, the chair said to proceed, so we were going to go one by one through the bill.
Okay, sure, go
but
ahead.
Now that you're in charge, if you want to change the order, we're willing to do that.
No, we're fine.
Okay. Then the next.
I do have another direction. I think this is good because I do need the next expert. Kathy, would you please come on up, please, because you're part of this group,
you
too.
You guys stay.
Oh, okay. Everybody stays, and you stay. This is how we get it done quick. Well, not quick, but at least we get it done together. Together.
Exactly. Okay. The next bill that is part of the access bill?
69.
Oh, 69. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Osborne. I'm a senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I can tell you that Juvenile Rights Project is in support of this bill. It is a significant problem. Senator Metzger asked whether there's been some legal cases. Certainly, parents have not been put in the position that our office has been aware of where the parents are being looked at being punished because the parents didn't understand the rules. But certainly, we have had many cases go through our office where the children are later punished because the parents did not understand the rules. And oftentimes it's because, when it gets right down to it, the child who was acting as the interpreter did not properly inform the parents that their curfew was actually at 7 p.m. And so when they were caught out at 9 p.m., that child is then put into detention for violating the conditions of release. What that does, what studies have shown, is when kids come to a court hearing from detention, they're more likely to be put back into detention for punishment, and those kids that spend significant time in detention are more likely to then be removed from their parents later on down the road. So certainly our hope is that if we can have interpreters for the parents, we're going to cut down on those juveniles who are then violated for violating their conditions of release. From my point of view, as an attorney who's representing the child, it's also difficult for me to explain to the parents ahead of time from the hearing about what's going to be happening to their child. Usually what happens is I meet with the parents before the hearing, and I explain to them the purpose of the hearing, what's going to happen, what the procedures are going to be, what kind of the court, especially if they've never been in court before, what the courtroom rules or etiquette is. You know, to stand up when the judge comes in, and how the whole system works. If I can't communicate with those parents, I have not been able to therefore afford to that bond with that family, which significantly hurts my ability to then continue to work with the child and that family. In looking through this list, and I asked the attorneys in our office to tell me what cases in the past year they have had situations where their client has spoken English and the parents have not spoken English, what languages they had then had problems in terms of interpretation. In our office, in the last year, we have had a family that spoke Arabic, Cambodian, French, German, Hmong, Korean, Laotian, Vietnamese, Tongan, Russian, Somalian, and there was also, I believe, a Portuguese case. So in our office, where we take not very many cases, those are the families that we have had problems communicating with because the children spoke English, the parents did not, and there were not interpreters for those parents. For many of those languages, you can imagine there's not somebody hanging around juvenile court that speaks those languages that can come up quickly and interpret for those families. So that is a significant problem. We would support the passage of this bill.
Questions of the witness?
Thank you.
The next bill, I'm going to just put our testimony for the next 3 hours.
So we completed 59.
The next bill is Senate Bill 76, and it's what I refer to as more of a technical cleanup. It simplifies a procedure for putting qualifications of the interpreter on the record when it's a certified interpreter that is doing the interpreting for the proceeding. And right now, before each and every case that an interpreter is used, they're supposed to put their qualifications on the record officially. And a number of the proceedings that are certified interpreters are interpreting in are like arraignments and multiple case proceedings that occur at a fairly quick pace. So under this change, if you're already a certified interpreter, it means you've passed minimum skills tests. That's on record. You have your sworn statements on record to abide by the interpreter code and also to uphold the law and the other provisions. If you have that all already on the record, not to have to state it before each case. Except in the situation where if you're in a trial and you're doing the interpreting of the witness, that you're sworn to uphold would be still put on the record. And then if you're not a certified, the provisions would apply that are in statute now, which is you have to be qualified before you can start qualified on the record. So Judge Lagard may have some real life information on that, but that's the purpose of this change.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Just members of the committee, it's sort of like the rule you just passed that said we don't have to read our the bills before we vote on them word for word. What happens in these proceedings, because all the attorneys know this person is certified, is before every single proceeding, and there might be 50 in a 2.5 hour period, and let's say 20 of them involve Spanish speaking interpreters. Do you stipulate or waive the court going through the statutory procedure before we begin this proceeding with his interpreter? The attorney says yes. Go on with the proceeding at last 2 minutes. Next proceeding, just do it over and over and over again. So it's become and it's as a result of an appellate decision interpreting the statute. So it's really just cleaning the statute up to go back to a practice we had before, which as long as you had a certified interpreter, you didn't discuss their qualifications. You just move forward.
Questions?
I have to ask the question, Judge. Did you say it's sort of like the bill we just...
Well, I just heard this morning, Vice Chair, heard this morning on the radio that there was a rule that the legislature passed that said that where you waive the requirement that the legislature reads word for word the bills before they're voted on the floor.
That was on the radio?
Yes, it was.
Is this your bill, Senator Corker?
No, no, that's fine.
Yeah, he suspended the Constitution.
All of us all, just sort of a matter-of-fact type of explanation. I didn't go into anything more about discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
Where are we, Peter?
I think we have just completed, as far as these witnesses concerned, the Supreme Chair discussion, analysis, and questioning of SB 76.
Was there a fiscal impact on this? Did
we didn't get into fiscal impact on this one, so I don't know.
Was there any?
Is there only one with fiscal impact this year?
Yeah.
No, there's one. Chair Minister, is not a fiscal on this except for the intangible of time savings.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's a procedural question. I see in Senate Bill 69 it says a fiscal impact statement is issued, but I haven't seen one. Is it not the habit of the committee to get fiscal impact statements from your members?
Normally we do. This has been my experience in the past, but I think that Maryland just indicated there was a fiscal impact statement because the amount was less than $50,000.
It's been our practice, if the fiscal impact is above $50,000, to give you the statement. Otherwise, we don't receive a dollar amount on the statement we receive from legislative fiscal. It just says there is an impact, but it's less than $50,000.
So we can get to the official form, but it says impact is less than $50,000.
If you want the forms in all the cases, I can provide them.
Mr. Chair, I guess it's a procedural question, or I guess it may be a more appropriate question for legislative fiscal, but in years past, in my vast experience in the legislature, that we have received fiscal statements that have been as low as $1 if they can do that, because even if it's less than $50,000, that was just an arbitrary threshold. It means that the committee chair is supposed to send it to Ways and Means, but yet every dollar we spend that is not in the governor's budget or is not anticipated by the Ways and Means chairs is potentially a dollar that we're out of balance. So I guess it's maybe a question that, you know, that needs to be asked of legislative fiscal, why we're not seeing a fiscal statement if it's less than $50,000.
Well, my experience, although limited too, has been such that if the committee chairs and the co-chairs want a bill, they'll get a bill. Or if, for instance, something comes across the floor that has a significant fiscal impact that they hadn't anticipated, they'll ask for it at that time. But in past practices, if there is a $50,000 or less threshold, then they usually do not go to Ways and Means. The co-chairs just simply track them. And you're right, we have had fiscal statements before with, you know, smaller than that amount. But we have no direction from the co-chairs or leadership regarding sending bills to Ways and Means with a fiscal less than $50,000. So
I understand that, but it still seems that the committee member should know and should know what that amount is. I mean, whether it's $1 or $49,999, it still, in my opinion, makes a difference on when you're deciding policy. You have to, as much as we'd like to say, you know, we set public policy and we let somebody else pay for it, that's not the case. We set public policy, and well, we have to pay for it. And so I think we is.
Well, I mean, we can shut all the committees down and just let Ways and Means do the dictating for us if you'd like.
No, that's not an alternate choice. That's not what I'm suggesting, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just like to know what the amount is, even if it's only, you know, just to say it's less than $50,000. You know, you pass 10 bills that have $49,999, and that's $500,000.
Right. And having been down there before, $500,000 is not a lot of money. Trust me.
I understand that mentality sometimes.
It's the truth. It's the truth. You can find. I can go down there tomorrow and find you $100 million if you want it. It depends on where I get it from.
That's very good point, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe this discussion should be in work session instead of public hearing. But I still think.
Well, what's your desire? What do you want us to do?
I would just like. I'm not asking we send the bill to Ways and Means. I would just like to see the fiscal statement.
Okay.
That's all.
We'll have staff get you a fiscal. Everybody will get fiscals. We'll just the paper. We'll kill trees. That's you're in that business, aren't you?
Actually, now you're getting the money.
All right, now I'm getting it. Okay, we will get everybody fiscal impact statements, and if you want any other information, background, just let us know. We'll get it to you.
Mr. Chair.
We'll kill as many trees as you want.
Mr. Chair, I would like to know what's the impact on staff for that.
Well, they're here to serve.
Well, I understand that. I understand that. But everything we ask them to do takes time and so forth. Is it a major problem or is it not?
I'll just have to ask legislative fiscal. Do you have that statement I gave you?
It's buried in here somewhere.
Okay. At the present time, what they give me is a sheet that says, this office has reviewed the proposed legislation and determined that it has underlined no expenditure impact and underline on state or local governments. And that's the kind of statement that legislative fiscal is issuing for where the expenditure is less than the $50,000 requiring the referral.
So this is what you get?
That's what I get. I can ask for the underlying, contact the analyst and ask for the underlying records on those, either in all cases or in specific cases, if I have some direction from the committee.
Mr. Chair, I guess maybe legislative fiscal is doing things different this session than they did last session. I have not asked for a fiscal statement in my committee yet, the business committee, but if that's all they're doing is saying there is no fiscal impact, then that's all we need to say is there is no fiscal impact. Because to me, that's what that statement says, there is no fiscal impact.
Okay. So
if there is no fiscal impact, then let's just say that and move on.
Okay.
They are distinguishing between those two types. There is a statement that comes back, no fiscal impact, which essentially I would read as zero. And there is this one, which I believe their reference to no expenditure impact means that it's below the 50,000.
Okay. Great.
At least that way they've already been alerted, so there's no.
Anybody else have any questions, concerns? Background documents you want, just ask us for whatever you want. We'll get it. Okay, where were we, by the way? We got on the fiscal thing. We're done with 76?
Chair Minnis, we're done with 76 unless you had some other folks signed up on it. Well, that was the vice chair's rule. So we're ready to go to Senate Bill 77.
We work in concert with each other.
Okay.
So,
we already passed it.
Whatever the vice chair wants, for the most part, we'll grant it. Almost. Okay. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 76 that didn't sign up or feels compelled to or wants to? That's what I thought the bill. Okay. Are you going to go to the next one?
Yes, sir. For the record, I guess. Can I get a waiver on this? Seems like secret administrator. Senate Bill 77 changes the statute regarding the use of interpreters in grand jury proceedings to mirror the same requirements for use of interpreters in trial court proceedings. And basically that rule is a requirement that a qualified interpreter who is certified is to be called first if one is able and available to provide the services. Right now, the statute governing use of interpreters in grand jury proceedings does not require that a certified interpreter be brought in if available and used first. And this change, the Access Committee has proposed as an added protection to the integrity of the criminal justice process, just because clearly the issues coming out of the grand jury and indictment, you would want the case to proceed as appropriate and not be subject to challenges because of issues and miscommunications that happened during the grand jury proceedings. This one does not have a fiscal for the judicial department. Mark Huddleston, who's a district attorney from Jackson County, is on the Access Committee. At the time of this bill did not believe there was a fiscal impact issue for the district attorneys. I know Dale Penn is here. If there is one, it would just be to the extent that a district attorney is not now using certified interpreters and relying on some other resource to provide interpretation at the grand jury proceeding. And I don't know if Judge Legert has any comments yet on this one.
Yeah, I just, for record, Judge Legert, Chair, members of the committee, this is a make sense thing. It doesn't make any sense to have a different standard at the trial than you would at the grand jury level. It's the same issues that are being decided by the jurors in terms of witnesses testifying.
Okay. Questions? Dale, you want to come up and put your 2 cents worth in on this one while you're here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney and represent the District Attorney Association. I have a couple of issues here. One of them, I mean, the idea of having appropriate interpreters, that's certainly a good goal. We have no objection to that goal. I would like to see some amendment in the language because the present statute now requires us to do a motion, affidavit, and order every time we're going to have an interpreter. And I would rather have it say something like, if you use a court-certified interpreter, then there is no requirement of the order. However, if you don't have a court-certified interpreter so that you have to use someone, that is when a judge really needs to hear, okay, what are your qualifications? And that would just stop us. I could, as I was thinking about this, we're going to be constantly filing motions and orders now when the intent is to have court certified interpreters.
So your motion or your amendment would be to streamline the process?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Did this group consider that issue at all? Or?
No, and I'm certain, unfortunately, Mr. Chair, Mr. Huddleston just sent me a fax yesterday about this, and I really hadn't had a chance to review this well. And so we didn't have a chance to discuss it. The other thing is I did learn something in this process because Legislative Fiscal called me yesterday wanting to know, okay, what's the cost? And this one doesn't have any state cost. It will all be county cost. And I mistakenly told him that, well, no, I think the court administrator pays for these interpreters. And so he called my court administrator and found out, no, Dale pays for these. And what I determined was I do use the court administrator's list, which is certified interpreters. And I thought they were paying for it, but I'm paying for it. But the whole issue, I just wanted to make this point. This is not a lot of money that would be involved. It really would boil down to now, ultimately, court-certified interpreters will start charging more money than other people and say, well, we're court-certified. And that's a minimal issue. I wanted to raise this issue, though. It is another point where the counties and DA's offices will have to pick up this cost. You will hear me raise that theme throughout this session because the state provides 9% of the resources for prosecution of state crimes. So I have no objection to the fiscal impact on this. It's not big. Maybe we can just have some streamlining the process, and I think it would work well.
Could I ask for an opinion? Do you think this is a good bill with respect to providing information to people that might not otherwise have it? I mean, in other words, I think we have to do kind of a cost-benefit analysis.
Certainly.
My opinion has always been, I really don't care what it costs. If there's an overriding public interest, then we ought to be able to at least attempt to find the resources to do that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I agree with that, and that's why we support the bill. I just bring that up. Some of you may be involved in the Ways and Means process, and you'll hear me talk about this at greater length than other issues, but I just wanted to make the point.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any other comments on Senate Bill 77?
Chairman, it's just that I think the conceptual amendment proposed by Mr. Penn is appropriate and would be well accepted by us.
You wouldn't mind if we had staff draft that?
No, that would be great.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dale. Appreciate it. We do have someone here from Fiscal, Ways and Means, whatever. So would you want to come up and identify yourself and instruct us with respect to the honorable high co-chairs of Ways and Means and their directing towards these committees?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Siebert. I'm with the Legislative Fiscal Office. To get at Senator Byer's question about why you didn't have an actual fiscal impact statement for the prior bill, actually, was that for bills under $50,000, we issue a form, our office issue a form that says this is a minimal impact. We started that last session. We have all the documentation of what the actual dollar cost is in our files before we issue that statement, so that if any question arises later on, for example, if the agency comes back and to the emergency board and says that this is a significant cost, we have the documentation showing what they said the cost would be, and the emergency board may look not as favorably on that request at that point. It was strictly implemented as a workload matter. We were churning out a lot of fiscal impact statements. Our staff was. We have a staff of essentially three people that do fiscal impacts for all the bills that come through both houses. So it was just really a workload matter. But rest assured, we have all the backup material, what the dollars amount, any bill that you would like to know, what the actual dollar amount is. When you see a minimal impact, you can call our office and we can get you that information.
Any questions?
I have a question of that. Just for my own education here. So you've already done the research.
Right.
So you know that, for example, the bill is estimated at $25,000. I mean, do you do that, or you just say
$48,643?
Okay. I guess my only point is, I think Senator Beyer had a good point here. I mean, if you know it's $48,200, and you're going to type up and send to the administrator, this is under $50,000. Why don't you just write it's under $50,000 in parentheses $48,000? I mean, if you already have it, I mean, I thought that part of it is, if the work is done, and someone wants to see it, to type the extra two words.
We could
just a curious. I'm not asking, Mr. Chair, but it sounds like they've already done it and they just didn't type that number on.
We all have a certain span of control, and this gentleman works at the pleasure of the co-chairs and Mr. Stinson and the House and the Senate, and everybody else is putting pressure on them. So I think they're trying to deal with workload issues as best they can. So, we have a limited amount of control in terms of what they're going to produce, unless we want to take it back to our respective caucuses and leaderships and jump up and down and scream yell and demand. They're willing to cooperate. They've always been willing to cooperate. And our staff is available because we do get at least a preliminary document, maybe some additional information. We can generate it, if you would like to have it. But we'll get you anything you want that's within our reach and our grasp, because we want this committee to make good decisions and sound decisions based on available information. Senator Hart.
Could you perhaps refresh me on the current rules on state-mandated programs?
There is a limit. I just don't recall what it is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, there is a limit. What you're referring to is what was ballot measure 30. I believe the limit is it's either a half of 1% of an entity's budget or 1%, more than 1% or more than one half of 1% of an entity's budget for an annual expenditure. So that's one of the trigger points. There are a number of trigger points. I have a complex flow chart that explains to me when the mandated payments kick in. And I don't believe this bill reaches the threshold. On our form, you'll see a line that talks about the mandated payments, and we signify on there if our office feels that this is a state mandated payment that reaches that threshold.
Follow up.
Go ahead, sir.
How do you feel whether it does or doesn't?
Senator Harper, we get as much research as we can. It's often difficult with local entities to get that kind of information, because what may be a less significant impact for a large, let's say Multnomah County, as opposed to a small city in rural Oregon, there's a great disparity. So we attempt to look at what we feel the impact would be and what we think the impact would be on local governments and make our best judgment call.
I think there's another issue too. I think a lot of municipalities, local governments are also in budget building processes, so you may not know specifically those figures right up front. So it's kind of a quandary that they're in terms of determining whether it's actually going to come to that threshold amount or not. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, sir. I appreciate you coming up. Okay, where are we?
Senate Bill 78. Senate Bill 78 provides a statutory framework for using interpreters for non-English speaking jurors. As a little bit of background, the statute provides a qualification of jurors. They must be a resident of the county in which they've been summoned. They must be 18 years of age and older. They must be a U.S. citizen. There are also provisions on conviction of felonies and other types of qualifications. The statute does not require an ability to communicate in English nor any fluency level in English. So whatever a U.S. citizen has as their level of fluency, they can still be brought in under a summons for jury service. The statute right now only provides for interpreters under the federal American with Disabilities Act, where you have a disability or you're hearing impaired or deaf, and under the statutory provisions, you are provided with an interpreter. In those circumstances, that person has authority to go into the juror deliberations room, and there also is authority for state payment. There is no similar process for foreign language, and there's a variety of reasons. But what's happening now is with the changing demographics in Oregon, the courts are seeing more and more persons who are U.S. citizens who are being called for jury service who have limited English proficiency. There are some cases that have occurred to date where the person may have gotten as far as the impanelment on the juror when then it's been discovered that their proficiency is low, or they all of a sudden feel like they are not proficient enough, and the judges have been put in the situation of getting both sides to stipulate to the use of this juror or not, and going forward in kind of a dicey area where there's no procedural guidance. We prefer that if this is going to continue to be the qualifications of jurors and the system, that there be statutory parameters for how this would work, both for the authority to pay, for the process of approving them and finding them. We also have in this bill some safeguard procedures that are also in there with the ADA ones, which there is a single case sort of exception a judge can make in the interest of judgment, that for whatever reason this particular juror, it's not appropriate for them to be involved in this case. Maybe you have a deaf or hearing impaired person, it's a music copyright case. I mean, I'm just trying to think of an extreme example where otherwise a criminal case, something else that might not be an issue. So there is a safety valve in the statutory procedures for the judge to exercise those provisions, because there's going to be languages for which they're not certified interpreters or ones available. There may be some other issues. But it does provide a procedure if a person meets all the other qualifications for serving as a juror to provide a foreign language interpreter. This does have a large fiscal impact because we have a state provision right now. There's no statutory authority for us to pay, so it's not in our budget. Like I said, in those few instances where it's occurred, there's been a specific court procedure for ensuring that a payment was made. It has not been litigated in this state yet. It has been litigated in other states. It's kind of one of those things that are on the cusp. So I do see it as a preventive measure and a procedural safeguard, but it does have a large fiscal. It does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means under the status report that I saw from the president's desk. It should, right. If you pass it out of this committee.
That would be my intent if we did pass it out. Mm-hmm. Add a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, not being an attorney and first time on judiciary, I realize I'm behind all my peers here, but this would seem to be, I'm surprised that this didn't already exist. I mean, this would seem to be a huge equal protection issue in terms of a jury of peers, and to the sense that the peer group is bound by, in some cases, maybe by language. Has there been litigation as a result of failure to have a jury of peers because of the inability, and maybe in some cases, to have that peer group where there's a bond of language?
Chairman and Senator Metzger, not that I'm aware of in Oregon yet, though now that we're having public hearings probably being filed, but I'm not aware. Judge Lager may be aware of any issues that have come up in her court.
Chair, Senator Metzger, I think one of the reasons the issue hasn't actually risen to a higher, like the Supreme Court, because there's several cases that the Supreme Court's decided that said if parties intentionally challenge, they have peremptory challenges and challenge people of minorities, or you could say people didn't speak the same language or had a native language that was different than English, that is unconstitutional. I think the reason these things haven't risen to that level is in order to make the record, it takes a lot to make a record in a particular case and then to have it go through the system where that would happen. I just recently tried, however, a death penalty case. The defendant was a white male, spoke English, but there was a challenge to the jury selection process. So we brought every juror in and had actually over 250 jurors on the first day to select. You have to have that large of a number in a death penalty case. We had four different interpreters there for people that had been summoned to the proceeding. Now, a lot of those jurors, a few of them didn't show up, and then the ones that showed up were either excused because they had something that allowed them to be excused, or they weren't a citizen. And so we haven't had this come up in a way that it's been set up for a challenge. But I don't disagree with you that that's partially what Kingsley Click was saying, that this is potentially, again, heading off if somebody really want to challenge it. And my remarks on that issue really, just to kind of follow up on what Kingsley said, was if you're a defendant and you don't speak English and we are excluding the people that are otherwise qualified because they are not fluent in English from participating in your trial, that you would certainly say that that violates your rights. And I would, as a judge being overly cautious, would say we're going to have to fix this right now so that this case isn't reversed on appeal, but you don't have a process to do that in statutes at this point. Pay for it.
Any other questions? Senator Burdick?
I guess it shows my ignorance of the citizenship process, but isn't there some level of English proficiency required in order to pass the tests that are done for citizenship?
Chair, if I may respond to that question, Senator Burdick, part of the issue when we're talking about interpreters for jurors or witnesses or defendants isn't that they don't speak, that they speak no English. It's that they're not able to understand all of what we're saying in a judicial proceeding. And I give an example of my own. I speak Spanish, but I would not want to be in a court in Mexico without having somebody interpreting everything that's said to me to make sure I understand it. And I would say, for instance, that you had a jury trial, wouldn't you want to make sure that juror understood everything and not just kind of understood everything and maybe thought they understood that vocabulary? So that's part of the issue. It's not a totally not speaking English. It's are they fluent enough to understand that proceeding?
Legal proceedings are often confusing in English, let alone
right.
A foreign language. So. I wanted to ask one question. Did the group consider this as a pilot program or to attempt a pilot program somewhere as opposed to statewide? And I'm thinking of that in terms of fiscal impact, if that's even practicable or not. And I don't know if that sets up a whole other set of legal problems once you begin to do that.
Chair Minnis, I think it didn't consider it in the full, but in part of it was if you had differing standards in different counties on this particular issue, that it would create a difficulty from the beginning, but we didn't explore that in great depth.
Okay. No other questions? Anybody?
I have a question.
No,
are there any other states that are providing interpreters for jurors?
Mr. Chair, committee counsel, yes, New Mexico. It's by constitution. The thing right now is the only states where it's happening, it's in their constitution. New Mexico, it was litigated, and their Supreme Court just in the last year or two. But in their constitution, it just requires it for Spanish speaking, though my understanding is they're doing it for all languages for which they have qualified. But the New Mexico opinion was just related to the, in their clause, for the Spanish-speaking. And I believe there's something similar in the California Constitution. I'm not aware of any state that doesn't have a constitutional provision where they have gone to this step yet, though I know that there are various, I'm not really aware of the most current situation with litigation in other states on that, but I know there's at present no other state that has that law except where their constitution required it.
I have a follow-up question. If you were to have a non-English speaking juror with an interpreter, would there be some special requirements that would be needed to assure that that person took the oath of secrecy as far as the deliberations and to actually perhaps swear that person in some special sense?
If I might respond to your committee counsel, we've had deaf interpreters, and the first time I had a deaf juror and the interpreter went in there, I was concerned about that, and I just did instruct them, but that's their oath. Says all they're supposed to do and all they will do is to just interpret the language that's spoken and communicate it back, and then we just added to that, what I added to that with the deaf interpreter for the juror was that they were not to communicate, just like a juror, anything that was said in the jury room. So you're right. I mean, that was something I did. I've had that happen twice now.
Hey, Senator Harper, sir.
Maybe I missed this, Mr. Chair, if I did, I'm sorry. Does this fiscal apply to all languages, or is there a limit, or so any language?
Chairman and Senator Harper, is the fiscal, because we don't have this now in statute, made some assumptions based on the number of non-English speaking persons who might be in the jury pool. There's a low end and a high end, and the present fiscal, I believe it's about $4.5 million, is based on a middle ground of perhaps 5%, well, it's 2.5% of the jury pool being non-English speaking, where there would be a certified interpreter. A recent case in Washington County in a murder case where it was one of those, came after the fact when it was impaneled, and do you have a mistrial or not, it was cost almost $10,000 for that. 2 weeks of interpretation for that juror.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. We're going to do about a 5-minute recess.
Thank you.